Only an hour ago, Tully had warned me not to attempt to play politics, just to tell the truth. But some combination of stubbornness and calculation told me not to give Lodegear what he wanted. I thought of how the scene in Masht had ended, with the onslaught of the Veilers, how they had observed what was going on and construed it as an emergence. I didn't have their training, but I knew an emergence when I saw one. "I did it on my own," I said. "I accept the consequences of my decision. I expected that one such consequence might be Anathem. In that expectation, I found my way to Orathena. There, I thought I might live in a Mathic style, even though thrown back. That I was returned to Tredegar and allowed to celebrate Imbrace is a surprise, and is an honor." The Convox was as silent as it was invisible. It was just me and Lodegear, floating in space on our scrap of plane. Frau Lodegear had given up on getting Jad and moved on to secondary targets.
"I really don't understand how you think. You say that your objective was to live in the Mathic style. You were doing that already, weren't you?"
He turned to face the crowd in the nave.
"Perhaps he just wanted to do it someplace a bit warmer."
The jest earned laughter from some, but I could also hear an indignant strain out there beyond the lights.
"Frau Lodegear wastes the time of the Convox," a man called out. "The topic of this plenary is the Visitation." "My Lochter has asked me to address him by what he claims is the correct title of Frau," Lodegear said in return. "And as he seems to take such matters so seriously, I am merely attempting to get the facts straight."
"Well, I'm glad I was able to assist you," I said. "What would you like to know about the Visitation?"
"Since we've all watched the Spiele that was recorded by your ETA collaborator, I should think that what would be most productive would be for you to relate those parts of your experience that did not make it into the Spiele. What went on during those rare moments when you were able to tear yourself away from your ETA friend?"
He was giving me so much to object to that I was forced to make a choice. I had to let the ETA baiting go for now. The best I could do was give the ETA a name. "Saman arrived and began to record images a few minutes after the probe landed," I began. "For several minutes, I saw what he saw."
"Not so fast. You're starting in the middle of the story,"
Frau Lodegear complained in an indulgent, fatherly style. "Very well," I said. "How far back do you think it would be useful for me to go?"
"As much as I'm fascinated by the arts and folkways of the cult of Orathena," Frau Lodegear said, "we ought to confine ourselves to the Visitation proper. Pray, begin at the first moment when it penetrated your awareness that something extraordinary was happening."
"It looked like a meteorite, which is unusual, but not extraordinary," I said. "It didn't burn out instantly, so I thought it must be a big one. At first, it was difficult to make sense of its trajectory until I figured out that it was headed toward us. I can't tell you at what point I drew the conclusion that it was not a naturally occurring object. We began to run down the mountain. While we were en route, the probe's parachute deployed."
"Now, when you say we, what size of group are you speaking of?"
Rather than wait for Frau Lodegear to drag this out of me, I volunteered. "Two, Orlo and I."
"Sant Orlo, yes, we know about him,"
Frau Lodegear said.
"He's all over the Spiele, but we haven't known until now how he arrived at the scene. He was the first to reach the bottom of the hole, was he not?"
"If by hole you mean the excavated Temple of Orathena, yes," I said.
"But that's at the foot of the volcano,"
he exclaimed, in a tone of voice that somehow managed to accuse me of being such a simpleton that I did not know this. "I'm aware of it," I said.
"But now we learn that you and Orlo were running down from the top of the volcano while the probe was parachuting into the hole."
"Yes."
"What of the others? Were they so entranced by contemplation of the Hylaean theoric world that they were unaware that an alien space probe was dropping into the middle of their camp?"
"They stayed up at the rim of the excavation while Orlo ran down to the bottom alone."
"Alone?"
"Well, I followed him."
"What on earth were you and Orlo doing on the top of the volcano after dark?"
Frau Lodegear managed somehow to ask this in a tone that elicited some titters from the audience. We weren't on the top, as ought to be obvious if you think for a moment about what a volcano is. This got a whole different kind of laugh. Even Frau Lodegear looked faintly amused.
But you were quite high up on its slopes.
A couple of thousand feet.
Above the cloud layer?
He asked, as if this were extremely significant. There were no clouds.
I ask you again, why? What were you doing?
Here I hesitated. I'd have liked nothing better than to help propagate Orlo's ideas, and I'd never have a better opportunity what with the whole Convox listening to me. But I'd only gotten to see a fragment of his argument. I didn't fully get what I'd heard. I knew enough, though, to know that it might lead to talk of encanters. Orlo and I went up the mountain to talk, I said. We became quite involved in our dialogue and didn't notice it was getting dark.
When you choose to employ the word dialogue, it causes me to think that the topic was something more weighty than the charms of your new Orathenan girlfriend,
Frau Lodegear said dryly. Damn, he was good. How could he know so precisely what it would take to fluster me? Bells began ringing high up on the precipice. It sounded like the call to Provener. How did they wind their clock here? A memory came to me of Leo, a few months ago, winding the clock with two black eyes after he had asked me to punch him in the face. I tried to summon whatever Leo had learned to summon that day. I forced myself to go on as if the blows had never landed. This much of your statement is correct, that it was a serious theoretical discussion.
And what was so much on Orlo's mind that he had to drag you up a volcano to get it off his chest?
I was rolling my eyes and shaking my head in amazement.
Did it have anything to do with the geometers?
He tried. Yes.
Then I don't understand your reticence on this topic. If it relates to the geometers, it is of interest to the Convox, is it not?
I'm reluctant because I only got to hear a small part of his thoughts and I fear I won't do them justice.
Stipulated. Everyone has heard and understood your disclaimer now, so you have no reason to go on hoarding information.
Because he was anathematized, Orlo lost the ability to gather data about the geometers. He never even saw the only good picture of their ship that he managed to take, so his thinking about them, from that point onwards, had to be based on the only givens he still had access to.
I thought you just said he had access to no givens.
None emanating from the icosahedron.
So just what other kind of givens are there?
The givens that you and I are taking in all the time, simply by virtue of being conscious, and that we can observe and think about on our own without any need for scientific instruments. Frau Lodegear blinked in fake amazement.
Do you mean to claim that the subject of your dialogue was consciousness?
Yes.
Specifically Orlo's consciousness? Since that presumably is the only one he has access to.
His and mine, I corrected him. Since I was part of the dialogue too, and it was clear that Orlo's observations of his consciousness tallied with my observation of mine.
But I thought you told me only a minute ago that this very same dialogue was about the geometers.
Yes.
But you now contradict yourself by admitting it was about the features shared between your consciousness and that of Orlo.
And that of the geometers, I said, because they clearly possess consciousness.
Oh.
Frau Lodegear exclaimed and got a faraway look in his eyes, as if trying to wrap his mind around something impossibly absurd.
Are you trying to say that just because you and Orlo are conscious, and the geometers are too, which I'll give you for the sake of argument, that you can learn something about how the geometers' minds work simply by gazing at your own navel long enough?
Something like that.
Well, I'm certain that the Lorites are going to have a field day with this. But to me it seems you are saying too little and too much at the same time,
Frau Lodegear complained.
Too little, because we here on Arb have been gazing at our navels for 6,000 years and still don't understand ourselves. So what does it boot us to be as in the dark about the geometers as we are about our own minds? And too much, because you really are going too far in assuming that the geometers would think like us at all.
As to that last point, one can make strong arguments that all conscious beings must have certain mental processes in common.
Strong arguments that no disciple of Helicon will examine too closely, I'm sure,
Frau Lodegear said dryly, earning a chortle from every Prokian at the Convox. As to your first point, I continued, namely that we still don't understand ourselves after 6,000 years of introspection, I believe that Orlo was of the view that we might be able to settle some of those ancient questions now that we have access to conscious beings from other star systems. This settled the crowd down, and they became so markedly quiet that I knew they must all be concentrating intensely. We had got to the heart of the matter. The Svenic and Protan systems had been dueling for millennia and continued the struggle here in this nave under the names of Prokians and Helicarnians, Lodegear and Erasmus. The only thing they agreed on was the words I had just put in Orlo's mouth, that the geometers might tip the scales to one side or the other. Not necessarily because they would know the answers themselves, they might be just as confused as we were, but because of the new givens we could now obtain. And that was the true goal of many at this convox. Never mind whatever mission statement the secular power had handed us. Even Frau Lodegear knew to observe a few moments' silence, to give this the respect it deserved. Then he said,
If they were smart swarms of simple-minded bugs, or systems of pulsating energy fields, or plants speaking a chemical language to one another, something enormously different from us, then perhaps Orlo's lucubrations in the extinct pseudo-philosophy of Evanedric might provide us with a few moments' diversion. But the geometers look like us. Orlo couldn't have known that this was the case, so we may forgive him for his temporary delusion.
But why do they look like us? I asked, realizing as I said it that I was making a tactical error by asking a question, even a rhetorical one.
Let me help you,
Frau Lodegear said, magnanimously offering the hopelessly confused Fid a helping hand, his giant face on the screen above a picture of amused beneficence.
We know that for months and months, before anyone else knew that the geometers were up there, Orlo was up to something, using the cosmographical devices at your consent to track the icosahedron.
We know exactly what he was up to, I began. Frau Lodegear cut me off.
We know what you were told, a story that many of your own fraas and sewers refused to believe. And we know that Orlo was thrown back, that his fellow cultists in the shadowy group known as the Lineage spirited him halfway around the world to Ekba, by an amazing coincidence, the place where the geometers just happened to make their first landfall, and to do it on the very evening when this Orlo happened to mount a long and exhausting nocturnal expedition to the rarefied heights of an active volcano.
It's not long, it's not exhausting, and we didn't go up at night, I tried to say. But he had reduced me once again to quibbling, and all I'd done was let him draw breath and get a sip of water.
Help us now, Frau Erasmus,
Frau Lodegear said, in a perfectly reasonable tone.
Help us solve the riddle that has so bedeviled us.
Who is us in this case? I demanded.
Those here at the Convox, who sense that there is something more to Orlo than what we've been allowed to see on the Spiele.
I couldn't keep the tiredness out of my voice as I answered,
What riddle are you speaking of?
How did Orlo signal the geometers? What trick was he using to send them his secret messages?
Here, if I'd been having a drink, I'd have spat it out.
Frau Lodegear's statement raised a commotion. Waves of murmuring, shock, anger, and derisive laughter clashed, lapped, and rolled from one end of the nave to the other. I was too dumbfounded to speak, but merely stood there looking at him for a long while, waiting for him to show signs of embarrassment and withdraw the accusation. But the look on his face was as pleasant, as unself-conscious as it could be. And as his calm, his confidence waxed, mine waned. I wanted so desperately to plane him. But Orlo's words came back to me. They deciphered my analemma, as if he had somehow sent them a signal. Why else would they have chosen to land at Orathena, the very place in the whole world where Orlo had sought sanctuary? Why else would Orlo have made the long and hazardous journey to Orithena?
Back to the matter at hand.
I dare not enter a serious dialogue with Lodagir, here, before this audience, on this topic. He'd plane me so badly they'd have to scrub my remains off the floor with a sandblaster. And he'd take Orlo down with me. My dialogue with Fra Lodagir was being witnessed by seculars, important seculars, pangendrums, as Orlo would call them. Maybe his sleazy tricks were actually working on them. What was it people used to say of the Rhetors? That they had the power to alter the past, and that they did so every chance they got. I had no power to duel a Rhetor. All I could do was speak the truth and hope it might be heard by friends who could wield such power.
That's a novel suggestion, I said. I don't know how you do things in the Order of Saint-Proque, but as an Edharian, I would look for evidence.
What of the famous Steelyard?
Lodagir asked. The Steelyard favors the simpler hypothesis. Orlo not sending secret messages to an alien starship is simpler than what you are proposing.
Oh, no, Fra Erasmus, said Lodagir with an indulgent chuckle.
I'll not let you slip that one past me. Try to remember that intelligent people are listening to us. If Orlo sending messages explains what is otherwise mysterious, then it is the simpler hypothesis.
What mysteries do you think it explains?
3, to be exact. Mystery the first, that the probe landed on the ruins of Orithena, an otherwise desolate and uninteresting site whose most conspicuous feature is an analemma, clearly visible from space.
Anything is clearly visible from space if you have good enough optics, I pointed out. Remember that the geometers decorated their ship with a proof of the Adraconic theorem. What is more reasonable than for them to land on the Temple of Adracones?
They must know we're here, Lodagir pointed out. If they wanted to talk to Theors, why not simply land at Tredegar?
Why blast each other with shotguns? You can't burden me with responsibility for explaining everything that the geometers do, I said.
Mystery the second, Orlo's suicide.
No mystery there. He made a choice to preserve a priceless specimen.
He weighed his own life against that specimen, Lodagir said,
making a scale-balancing gesture with his two hands.
Mystery the third. He drew an analemma on the ground in the final instance of his life and stood on it to meet the fate he had chosen.
I had nothing to say. It was a mystery to me as well.
Orlo accepted his responsibility, Lodagir said.
You have completely lost me.
Somehow, Orlo sent a message to the geometers during those months when he was one of the only persons on Arb who knew it was up there. I speculate that the message took the form of an analemma, a sign telling the geometers to make their landfall on the analemma that is, or used to be, so clearly visible at Orithena. Once thrown back, he went there and waited. And lo, the geometers did make landfall there, but not in the manner that Orlo had, perhaps naively, anticipated. A faction among the geometers sent down an illicit probe. The alien woman sacrificed her life. The dominant faction retaliated by rotting Ekba, with deadly results at Orithena. Orlo understood that he bore responsibility for what had happened. Throwing the dead woman into the aircraft was his self-imposed penance, and drawing the analemma on the ground was his way of admitting responsibility for what he had done.
As Lodagir had proceeded through this indictment, his tone had changed, like an inquisitor at first, but softening as he went on, so that by the time he reached the last part, he seemed regretful, moved. I was spellbound. Perhaps this Rhetor did have magical powers to reach in and meddle with my brain, to change the past. But much more so, I was almost certain that he was right.
You still have no evidence, only a good story, I finally said. Even if you do find evidence and prove you're right, what does it really say about Orlo?
How could he have anticipated a civil war among the geometers? The geometer who gave the order to drop a rod on Ekba, doesn't he or she, and not Orlo, deserve responsibility for the deaths below? So even if some elements of your hypothesis are proved, there is still room for dialogue as to Orlo's state of mind when the glowing cloud struck him down. I think he was accepting a kind of responsibility, yes. But by planting himself on that analemma and waiting to die, I think he was saying something other than what you're trying to put in his mouth. I think he was saying, I stand by what I did in spite of all this.
A bit cheeky, wouldn't you say?
Don't you think he ought to have deferred to the secular power? Let them weigh the evidence, make a considered judgment as to how best we ought to treat with the geometers? Lodegear's eyes glanced to the side, as if to remind me that the Pangendrums were out there in the dark, listening for my answer. And now I made the only move out of this whole dialogue that I was later proud of. I did not say what I was thinking. The Warden of Heaven already tried that, remember? But I didn't have to. A low murmur had begun to run through the audience, building towards mirth. All I had to do was sit silently and wait for the whole convox to perceive just how ludicrous my Loctor's statement really was. And, I sensed, this had been a considered move on his part. That depends, I said, on how it all comes out in the end. Lodegear raised his eyebrows and turned away from me to face the Spielecaptor.
And that, he said, is the whole point of this convox. I suppose we ought to get to work.
He made a gesture. The microphones died and the Spiele screen went dark. Everyone in the nave began talking at once. I was alone on the platform, and it was dark. Frau Lodegear had scurried down the steps, probably so that I could not tear his tongue out with my bare hands. The crew were already dismantling the stage. I took off my microphone, had a good long drink of water, and trudged down the steps, feeling as if I had just spent an hour as a punching bag for Leo. A few people seemed to be waiting for me. One in particular caught my eye because he was a secular, dressed in important person clothes. He had made up his mind that he was going to be the first person to talk to me. So rather than wait for me to reach the bottom of the steps, he bounded up and met me halfway. Emmenbeldo, he said, and then rattled off the name of some government ministry or other. Would you mind telling me what the hell that was all about? He was younger than he looked in those clothes, I realized. Only a few years older than I. Why don't you ask Frau Lodegear, I suggested. Emmenbeldo chose to interpret that as dry humor. I came here expecting to hear about the geometers, he began, and instead we talked about consciousness and analemmas. Yeah, look, don't get me wrong. I put in 5 years as a Unarian. You're a literate, smart burger. You read stuff and use your brain for a living, but still you can't fathom what just happened. When we need to be talking about the threat and how to address it. I lost focus for a moment, gazing down to the base of the stairs where a cluster of Fras and Sewers all wanted to talk to me. I was trying to size them up without making eye contact. Some, I feared, styled themselves members of the lineage and wanted to exchange secret handshakes with me. Others probably wanted to spend the whole afternoon telling me why Evan Edric was wrong. There would be hardcore Helicarnians furious because I had not managed to plane for Alodegear, and people like Sewer Maroa, who had specific questions about what I'd seen at Orathena. I was thinking it might be easier to have a regular job like Emmenbeldo. Frau Lodegear saved me, sort of. He pushed forward to the base of the steps. He had just finished a heated discussion with a senior hierarch.
Well, now you've gone and done it, Frau Erasmus, he said.
Gone and done what, Frau Lodegear?
Gotten us relegated to the outer darkness, the arse end of the mathic world as far as I'm concerned.
Wouldn't that be the consent of Savant, Edahar?
No, there's one place left that's even worse, he proclaimed. The Plurality of Worlds Messel at Avershon's Dowment. That is where we will be taking our sustenance until I can get the Hierarchs to see reason.
Who's this we you're talking about?
You need to pay attention, Frau Erasmus.
Attention to what?
Your place in the convox.
And what is my place?
Standing behind me while I eat, folding my napkin when I get up to use the toilet.
What?
You are my servitor, Frau Erasmus, and I am your doyne.
I like a damp face cloth before dinner. Warm, but not too warm. See to it, if you don't want to spend the rest of the convox studying the book.
He turned and strode out. Emmenbeldo was looking at me interestedly. I should have been crushed by this terrible news, but I was a little punch-drunk, and it tickled me to see Fra Lodegear so irritated. Well, I said to Emmenbeldo, now you have a choice. If you want to learn about the threat posed by the geometers, you can go anywhere except where I'm going. If you want an answer to why we spoke of such out-of-the-way topics during this plenary, you can join me in Fra Lodegear at the arse end of the mathic world.
Oh, I'll be there, he said. My doyne wouldn't miss it.
And who is your doyne?
You and I will address her as Madam Secretary, he cautioned me. But her name is Ignatha Forel.
Part 10. Messel. Lorite. A member of an order founded by Saint Laura, who believed that all of the ideas that the human mind was capable of coming up with had already been come up with. Lorites are, therefore, historians of thought who assist other avowed in their work by making them aware of others who have thought similar things in the past and thereby preventing them from reinventing the wheel. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
The geometers have us pinned down like a biological sample on a table, said Ignatha Forel, after we had served the soup. They can poke and prod us at their leisure and observe our reactions. When we first became aware that they were in orbit around Arb, we assumed that something was going to happen soon, but it has been maddeningly slow. The geometers can get all the water they need from comets, all the stuff they need from asteroids. The only thing they can't do, we suspect, is go on interstellar voyages. But it could be that they aren't in that much of a hurry.
She paused to wet her whistle. A bracelet gleamed on her wrist. It looked valuable, but not gaudy. Everything about her confirmed what Tullia had told us months ago at Edhar, that she came from a moneyed burgher clan with old ties to the mathic world. It wasn't clear yet why she was here and carrying the impressive-sounding title of Madam Secretary. According to the information Tullia had dug up, she had been deposed from her secular job by the Warden of Heaven. But that was old news. The Warden of Heaven had been thrown out the airlock a few weeks ago. Perhaps, while I'd been distracted on Ekba, the secular power had reorganized itself, and she'd been dusted off and given a new job. Having taken a bit of refreshment, Madam Secretary made eye contact with the other six at the table. Or at least that's what I say to my colleagues who want to know why I'm wasting my time at this messel. She said this in a good-humored way. Fra Lodegear laughed richly. Everyone else was able to manage at least a chuckle except for Fra Jad, who was staring at Ignatha Forel as if she were the aforementioned biological specimen. Ignatha Forel was sharp enough to notice this. Fra Jad, she said, inclining her head slightly in his direction, in a suggestion of a bow, naturally takes the long view of things and is probably thinking to himself that my colleagues must have dangerously short attention spans. But my métier, for better or worse, is the political workings of what you call the secular power, and to many in that world this messel looks like a waste of some very good minds. The kindest thing some will say of it is that it is a convenient place to which difficult, irrelevant, or incomprehensible persons may be exiled, so that they don't get in the way of the more important business of the convox. How would you at this table recommend that I counter the arguments of those who say it ought to be done away with, Sir Asquin? Sir Asquin was our host, the current heritor of Avershon's dowment, hence its owner in all but name. Ignatha Forel had called on her first because she looked as though she had something to say, but also, I suspected, because it was the correct etiquette. For now, I was giving Sir Asquin the benefit of the doubt, because she had helped us make dinner, working side by side with her servitor, Triss. This was the very first Plurality of Worlds messel, and so it had taken us a while to find our way around the kitchen, get the oven hot, and so forth.
I believe I'd have an unfair advantage, Madam Secretary, since I live here. I'd answer the question by showing your colleagues around Avershawn's Dowment, which, as you've all seen, is a kind of museum.
I was standing behind Fra Lodegear with my hands behind my back, holding the knotted end of a rope that disappeared into a hole in the wall and ran 30 feet to the kitchen. Someone tugged on the other end of it, silently calling for me. I leaned forward to make sure that my Doyne didn't need his chin wiped, then walked around the table, sidestepping in front of other servitors. Meanwhile, Sir Asquin was trying to develop an argument that merely looking at the old scientific instruments scattered around the Dowment would convince the most skeptical extra that pure metatheorics was worthy of secular support. Seemed obvious to me that she was using hypertrochian transquestiation to assert that pure metatheorics would be the sole occupation of this messel, which I didn't agree with at all. But I couldn't speak unless spoken to, and I reckoned that the others here could take care of themselves. Fra Taverner, a.k.a. Barb, was standing behind Fra Jad, looking at Sir Asquin as a bird looks at a bug, just itching to jump in and plane her. I gave him a wink as I went by, but he was oblivious. I passed through a door, padded for silence, and entered a stretch of corridor that served as an airlock, or rather sound lock. At its end was another padded door. I pushed through, it was hinged to swing both ways, and entered the kitchen, a sudden and shocking plunge into heat, noise, and light. And smoke, since Arcibald had set fire to something. I edged toward the sand bucket, but not seeing any open flames, thought better of it. Sir Asquin could be heard over a speaker. The secular power had sent in Ita to rig up a one-way sound system so that we in the kitchen, and others far away, I had to assume, could hear every word spoken in the Messalin. "What's the problem?" I asked.
"No problem. Oh, this? I incinerated a cutlet. It's all right. We have more."
"Then why'd you yank me?" He made a guilty glance at a plank on the wall with 7 rope ends dangling from it, all but one chalked with a servitor's name.
"Because I'm desperately bored," he said. "This conversation is stupid."
"It's just getting started," I pointed out. "These are just the opening formalities."
"It's no wonder people want to abolish this messel if this is a fair sample of—"
"How is yanking my rope going to help?"
"Oh, it's an old tradition here," Arcibald said. "I've been reading up on it. If the dialogue gets boring, the servitors show their disdain by voting with their feet, withdrawing to the kitchen. The Doynes are supposed to notice this."
"The odds of that actually working with this group are about as high as that this dinner won't make them sick."
"Well, we must begin somewhere."
I went over to the ropes, picked up a lump of chalk, and wrote Emin Beldo under the one that was still unlabeled.
"Is that his name?"
"Yeah. He talked to me after plenary."
"Why didn't he help cook?"
"One of his jobs is driving Madam Secretary around. He only got here 5 minutes ago. Anyway, extras can't cook."
"Raz speaks the truth," said Sir
Triss, coming in from the garden with a boatload of firewood.
"Even you guys seem a little challenged."
She hauled open the hatch of the oven's firebox and gazed on the coal bed with a critical eye.
"We shall prove our worth anon," said Arcibald,
picking up a huge knife like a barbarian warlord called to single combat.
"This stove, your produce, your cuts of meat, all strange to us."
And then, as if to say, "Speaking of strange," Arcibald and I both glanced over at a heavy stew pot, which had been pushed to the back of the stove in hopes that the vapors belching out of it would stink less if they came from farther away. Sir Triss was nudging coals around and darting bits of wood into the firebox as if it were brain surgery. We had made fun of her for this until our efforts to manage it ourselves had produced the kinds of outcomes normally associated with strategic nuclear warfare. Now we watched contritely.
"Kind of weird for Madam Secretary to open by saying the messel's a drain trap for losers," I said.
"Oh, I disagree. She's good," Triss exclaimed. "She's trying to motivate them." Triss was podgy and not especially good-looking,
but she had the personality of a beautiful girl because she'd been raised in a math. I wonder how that's going to work on my Doyne, I said. He'd like nothing more than to see this canceled, so he can go dine with cool people. A bell jingled. We turned to look around. Seven bells were mounted to the wall above the seven rope ends. Each was connected by a long ribbon routed through the wall and under the floor to the underside of the table in the messaline, where it terminated in a velvet pull. A Doyne could summon his servitor, silently and invisibly, by yanking on the pull. The bell rang once, paused, then began to jangle non-stop, more and more violently until it looked like it was about to jump off the wall. It was labeled Fra Lodegear. I returned to the messaline, walked around behind him, and bent forward.
Get rid of this Edharian gruel, he breathed. It is perfectly unpalatable.
You should see what the Matterites are cooking up, I muttered. Fra Lodegear glanced across the table at an avout, one of those who had celebrated Inbrace with me earlier in the day, whose face was covered by his or her bolt. The fabric had been drawn sideways over his or her head, as if to form a hood, but the hood had then been pulled down to cover the face, with an opening below through which food, if that was the correct word for what the Matterites put into their mouths during meals, could be introduced.
I'll have what it's having, Lodegear hissed, but not this.
I glanced significantly at Fra Jad, who was shoveling the stuff into his mouth, then confiscated Lodegear's serving and whisked it out of there, happy to have an excuse to go back to the kitchen. Perfectly unpalatable, I repeated, heaving it into the compost.
Perhaps we should slip him some Allswell, Arcibald suggested.
Or something stronger, I returned. But before we could develop this promising theme, the back door swung open and in walked a girl, swathed in a hectare of heavy, scratchy-looking black bolt, lashed to her body with 10 miles of cord. Her punched-in sphere was overflowing with mixed greens. Out of doors, she kept her head covered, but once she had set the greens down, she swept her bolt back to reveal her perfectly smooth dome, all dotted with perspiration, since it was a warm day and she was overdressed. Arcibald and I did not feel as easy around Sur Carval as we did around Triss, so all banter stopped. That's a lovely selection of greens, Triss began. But Carval flinched and held up a bony, translucent hand, gesturing for silence. Fra Lodegear had begun speaking. I reckon that was why he had wanted his gruel cleared away.
Plurality of worlds, he began,
and let it resonate for a long moment.
Sounds impressive. I haven't the faintest idea what it means to some here. The mere fact of the geometer's existence proves that there is at least one other world, and so on one level it is quite trivial. But since it appears that I am the token Prokian of this messel, I shall play my role and say this. We have nothing in common with the geometers. No shared experiences, no common culture. Until that changes, we can't communicate with them. Why not? Because language is nothing more than a stream of symbols that are perfectly meaningless until we associate them, in our minds, with meaning, a process of acculturation. Until we share experiences with the geometers and thereby begin to develop a shared culture, in effect to merge our culture with theirs, we cannot communicate with them, and their efforts to communicate with us will continue to be just as incomprehensible as the gestures they've made so far. Throwing the Warden of Heaven out the airlock, dropping a fresh murder victim into a cult site and rotting a volcano.
As soon as he paused, reactions came through on the speakers, several people talking over each other.
I don't agree that those are incomprehensible.
But they must have been watching our spielies.
You're missing the point of the plurality of worlds.
But Sewer Asquin spoke last and most distinctly.
Many other messels are addressing the topics you mentioned, Fra Lodegear. In the spirit of Madam Secretary's opening question, why should we have a separate plurality of worlds messel?
Well, you might simply ask the hierarchs who brought it into existence,
Fra Lodegear answered a little disdainfully.
But if you want my answer as a Prokian, why, it is quite straightforward. The arrival of the geometers is a perfect laboratory experiment, as it were, to demonstrate and to explore the philosophy of Saint Proke. put simply, that language, communication, indeed thought itself, are the manipulation of symbols to which meaning are assigned by culture, and only by culture. I only hope that they haven't watched so many of our spieles that their minds have been contaminated and the experiment ruined.
And this relates to our theme, how?
Sewer Asquin prodded him.
She knows perfectly well,
Sewer Triss assured us. She's just making sure it all gets spelled out for Ignatha Forl.
Plurality of worlds means a plurality of world cultures, cultures hermetically sealed off from one another until now, hence for the time being, unable to communicate.
According to Prokians,
someone put in. I didn't recognize the oddly accented voice, so I thought it might be the Matterite.
The purpose of this missile, accordingly, is to develop and, I would hope, implement a strategy for the secular power, assisted by the Avowed, to break down the plurality, which is the same thing as developing a shared language. We shall put ourselves out of business by making the plurality of worlds into one world.
He hates this missile, I translated. So he's trying to talk Ignatha Forl into turning it into something else, which would just happen to be a power base for the Prokians. Sewer Carvel really hated it when we talked over the Doines, but she was going to have to get used to it. We were all standing around, distributing the greens among half a dozen salad plates. Only six, because Matterites, apparently, didn't eat salad. While making dinner, some of us servitors had had a good argument as to why a Matterite had been invited. One theory was simply that, because the secular power was religious, they wanted some Deolaters in on the discussion. The Matterites were going to have Convox's clout way out of proportion to their significance in the Mathic world, this argument went, because the Panchendrums felt more comfortable with them. The other theory was more in line with the notion, just voiced by Ignatha Forl, that this messel was a dumping ground. Clanking sounds over the speaker told us that those servitors who were still in the messelin were collecting the soup bowls. This led to a break in the dialogue, but we could hear an elderly woman's voice speaking up in a more informal mood as the servitors worked.
I believe I can put your fears to rest, Frau Lodegear.
Why, that's good of you, Grand Sir Moira, but I don't remember voicing any fears, said Frau Lodegear, trying and failing to sound jovial.
Moira was Carval's doine, so out of respect for Carval, we actually did shut up for a moment. Moira returned.
I believe you did express concern that the geometers had contaminated their own culture by watching too many of our spieles.
Of course you are right. That's what I get for contradicting a Lorite,
Frau Lodegear said. The door opened, and in came Barb with seven bowls stacked on his arms.
I think you ought to change my designation,
said Moira delicately, after considering this for a moment.
And now call me a Metalorite, or in honor of this occasion, a plurality of worlds Lorite.
This got a murmur out of everyone, in the messelin and in the kitchen. Sewer Carval had drifted over to the speaker and was standing there, rapt. Arcibald had been chopping something. He stopped and poised his knife above the block.
We Lorites are always making nuisances of ourselves, Moira said, by pointing out that this or that idea was already come up with by someone else long ago. But now I do believe we shall have to broaden our sphere to include the plurality of worlds, and say, I'm terribly sorry, Frau Lodegear, but your idea was actually dreamed up by a bug-eyed monster on planet Zarzax 10 million years ago.
Laughter around the table.
Splendid,
Arcibald said. He turned and looked at me.
She's a closet Halicarnian,
I said.
Exactly.
Frau Lodegear had seen the same thing and was trying to lodge an objection.
I'd say you can't know such a thing until you communicate with that bug-eyed monster or his descendants.
And then he went on to reiterate what he had said before. I rushed the salad out in the hopes that it would shut him up. Sewer Moira didn't seem quite taken with his arguments, and Ignatha Forl was beginning to look a little frosted. Meanwhile, Arcibald's doine, who happened to be seated next to Fra Jad, was leaning to exchange whispers with the Thousander. When first I'd seen this man, he had struck me as oddly familiar. Only when Archibald told me his name had I realized where I'd seen him before, standing alone in the chancel of St. Edhar, looking straight up at me. This was Fra Paphlagon. Fra Jad nodded. Paphlagon cleared his throat as Lodegear began to wind down and finally barged in.
"Perhaps, while we're proving that everything St. Proke ever wrote was just perfect, we can get some theorics done, too."
This shut even Lodegear up, so there was a short pause. Paphlagon continued.
"There's another reason for having a messel about the plurality of worlds. A reason that some would say is almost as fascinating as Fra Lodegear's remarks about syntax. It is a pure theoretical reason. It is that the geometers are made of different matter from we. Matter that is not native to this cosmos. And what is more, we have results just in from laboratorium concerning the tests that were performed on the four vials of fluid, assumed to be blood, on the ECMA probe. These four samples are made of different matter from each other, which is to say that each of them is as different from the other three as it is from the matter we are made of."
"Fra Paphlagon, I was only made aware of this as I was en route. I'm still absorbing it," said Ignatha Forel. "Say more, please, of what you mean when you speak of the matter being different."
"The nuclei of the atoms are incompatible," he said.
Then, surveying the faces at the table, he shifted back in his chair, grinned, and held up his hands like parallel blades, as if to say, "Imagine a nucleus."
"Nuclei are forged in the hearts of stars. When the stars die, they explode, and the nuclei are thrown out as ash from a dead fire. These nuclei are positively charged. So, when things get cool enough, they attract electrons and become atoms. Further cooling enables the atom's electrons to interact with one another to form complexes called molecules, which are what everything is made of. But again, the making of the world begins in the hearts of stars, where those nuclei are forged according to certain rules that only apply in very hot, crowded places. The chemistry of the stuff we are made of reflects, in a roundabout way, those rules. Until we learned to make new matter, every nucleus in our cosmos was made according to the set of rules that naturally obtains. But the geometers are aware of, they are made of, four other slightly different but totally incompatible sets of rules for making nuclei."
"So," said Suhr Asquin, "they too learned to make new matter, or..."
"Or they came from different cosmi,"
Fra Paphlagon said,
"which makes a plurality of worlds messel seem awfully relevant to me."
"This is bizarre, fantastical," said a reedy voice with a heavy and strange accent.
No one's lips were moving that we could see, so by process of elimination we turned to the Matterite, who was chalked up on the bellboard as one Javarn, with no Fra or Suhr to give a clue as to sex. Javarn turned slightly in his seat, I was guessing male from the voice, and made a gesture. His servitor, a column of black fabric, loomed forward, grew a pseudopod, and took his plate, to the visible relief of those seated to either side.
"I can hardly believe we are talking about a possibility so inconceivable as that other universes exist, and that the geometers originate there."
In this, Javarn seemed to speak for the entire table, except for Jad.
"The words fail. There is one universe, by the definition of universe. It is not the cosmos we see through our eyes and our telescopes. That is but a single narrative, a thread winding through a hemmed space shared by many other narratives besides ours. Each narrative looks like a cosmos alone to any consciousness that partakes of it. The geometers came from other narratives until they came here and joined ours."
Having dropped this bomb, Fra Jad excused himself and went to the toilet.
"What on earth is he on about?"
Fra Lodegear demanded.
It sounded like literary criticism.
But he did not speak scornfully. He was fascinated.
So perhaps this missile has already turned into what its detractors claim of it, said Ignatha Forel.
And having issued that challenge, she turned toward the topic of the research she had performed years ago as a Unarian. Paphlagon was in his 7th decade, impressive-looking rather than handsome, no doubt accustomed to being the most senior, the most eminent person in any given room. He was sitting there with a trim, wry smile, staring at the center of the table, resigning himself, with all good humor, to being Fra Jad's interpreter.
"Fra Jad," he said, "speaks of hem space. It's probably just as well he broached the subject early. Hem space, or configuration space, is how almost all Theors think about the world. During the Praxic Age, it became obvious that it was a better place for us to go about our work, so we decamped, left three-dimensional Adrakonic space behind, and moved there. When you talk of parallel universes, you make as little sense to him as he does to you."
"Perhaps you can say a few words, then, about hemmed space, if it is so important," suggested Ignatha Forel.
Paphlagon got that wry look again and sighed.
"Madam Secretary, I am trying to think of a way to sum it up that will not turn this vessel into a year-long theorix suvin."
And he gamely launched into a primer on hemmed space. He learned to look to Sewer Moira whenever he got stuck. More often than not, she was able to drag him out of trouble. She had already shown herself to be good company. And the vast stock of knowledge that she, as a Lorite, carried around in her head made her good at explaining things. She could always reach back to a useful analogy or clear line of argument that some Fra or Sewer had written down in the more or less distant past. I got yanked in the middle of it, and, going back to the kitchen, found Emin Beldo on the other end of the rope. Javarn's servitor was standing at the stove, stirring the mystery pot, and so Emin and I wordlessly agreed to retreat to the other end of the kitchen, near the open door to the garden.
"What the hell are we talking about here?" Emin wanted to know. "Is this some kind of travel through the fourth dimension scenario?"
"Oh, it's good that you asked," I said, "because it is precisely not that. Hem space is anything but. You're talking about the old thing where a bunch of separate three-dimensional universes are stacked on top of each other like pages in a book, and you can move between them." Emin was nodding.
"By figuring out some way to move through the fourth spatial dimension. But this hem space thing is something else?"
"In hem space, any point, which means any string of n numbers where n is how many dimensions the hem space has, contains all the information needed to specify everything that can possibly be known about the system at a given moment."
"What system?"
"Whatever system the hem space describes," I said.
"Oh, I see," he said. "You're allowed to set up a hem space
anytime you feel like it," I said, "to describe the states of any system you are interested in studying. When you are a FID and your teacher sets a problem for you, your first step is always to set up the hem space appropriate to that problem."
"So what is the hem space that Jad's referring to then?" Emin asked. "What is the system that his hem space gives all of the possible states of?"
"The cosmos," I said.
"Oh."
"Which to him is one possible track through an absurdly gigantic hem space. But that very same hem space can have points in it that do not lie on the track that is the history of our cosmos."
"But they're perfectly legitimate points?"
"A few of them are. A tiny few, actually. But in a space so huge, a few can be enough to make many whole universes."
"What about the other points? I mean, the ones that aren't legitimate?"
"They describe situations that are incoherent somehow."
"A block of ice in the middle of a star," Arcipalt suggested.
"Yes," I said. "There is a point in hem space that describes a whole cosmos similar to ours, except that somewhere in that cosmos, there's a block of ice in the middle of a star. But that situation is impossible." Arcibald translated.
"There's no past history that could make it happen, so it can't be accessed by a plausible world track."
"But if you can suppress your curiosity about those for a moment," I said to Emin, "the point I was getting at was that you can string the legitimate points, ones not visited by our world track, but that makes sense,
into other world tracks that make as much sense as ours. But they're not real, Emin said. Or are they? I balked. Archibald said,
That is a rather profound question of metatheorics. All of the points in hem space are equally real, just as all possible XYZ values are equally real, since they are nothing more than lists of numbers. So what is it that imbues one set of those points, one world track, with what we call realness?
Sua Triss had been clearing her throat more and more loudly the last few minutes, and now graduated to throwing things at us. To this was added the jingling of several bells. It was time to bring out the main course. Other servitors had been picking up the slack for me and Emin, so we got very busy for a while. Several minutes later, the 14 were all back in their formal positions, Doines at the table, waiting for Sewer Asquin to pick up her fork, servitors standing behind them. Sewer Asquin said,
I believe we have all decided, albeit with some reservations, to move over into hem space with Fra Jad. And according to what we hear of it from Fra Paphlagon and Sewer Moira, there should be no lack of room for us there.
All the Doines laughed dutifully. Barb snorted. Archibald and I rolled our eyes. Barb was clearly dying to plain Sewer Asquin by explaining in excruciating, dinner-wrecking detail just how colossal the configuration space of the universe really was, complete with estimates of how many zeros it would take to write down the number of states it could describe, how far said string of digits would extend, etc. But Archibald raised a hand, threatening to rest it on his shoulder. Steady now. Sewer Asquin began to eat, and the others followed her lead. There was a little interlude during which some of the Doines, not Lodagear, made the requisite comments on how tasty the food was. Then Sewer Asquin continued,
But looking back on our discussion, I find myself puzzled by a remark that Fra Paphlagon made before the topic of hemspace was mentioned, concerning the different kinds of matter. Fra Paphlagon, I believe you were citing this as evidence that the geometers all came from different cosmi, or to use Fra Jad's term, different narratives.
A somewhat more conventional term would be world tracks, Sewer Moira put in. Use of narrative is somewhat, well, loaded.
You're speaking my language now, said Lodagear,
clearly delighted.
Who besides Fra Jad uses narrative, and what do they really mean by it?
It is rare, Moira said, and it is associated in some people's minds with the lineage.
Fra Jad appeared to be ignoring all of this.
Terminology aside, Sir Asquin went on a little brusquely, what I don't quite understand is how it all fits together. What is the link that you see between the fact of the different kinds of matter and the world tracks?
Paphlagon said,
The cosmogonic processes that led to the creation of the stuff we are made of, the creation of protons and other matter, their clumping together to make stars and the resulting nucleosynthesis, all seem to depend on the values of certain physical constants. The most familiar example is the speed of light, but there are several others, about 20 in all. Theors used to spend a lot of time measuring their precise values, back when we were allowed to have the necessary equipment. If these numbers had different values, the cosmos as we know it would not have come into being. It would just be an infinite cloud of cold, dark gas, or one big black hole, or something else quite simple and dull. If you think of these constants of nature as knobs on the control panel of a machine, well, the knobs all have to be set in just the right positions, or...
Again Paphlagon looked to Moira, who seemed ready.
Sir Demula likened it to a safe with a combination lock, the combination being about 20 numbers long.
If I follow Demula's analogy, said Javarin, each of those 20 numbers is the value of one of those constants of nature, such as the speed of light.
That is right. If you dial 20 numbers at random, you never get the safe open. It is nothing more to you than an inert cube of iron. Even if you dial 19 numbers correctly and get the other one wrong, nothing. You must get all of them correct. Then the door opens and out spills all of the complexity and beauty of the cosmos.
Another analogy, Moira continued after a sip of water, was developed by Saint Condorlin, who likened all of the sets of values of those 20 constants that don't produce complexity to an ocean 1,000 miles wide and deep. The sets that do are like an oil sheen, no wider than a leaf, floating on the top of that ocean. An exquisitely thin layer of possibilities that yield solid, stable matter suitable for making universes with living things in them.
I favor Condorlin's analogy, said Paphlagon. The various life-supporting cosmi are different places on that oil sheen. What the inventors of new matter did was to devise ways to move around, just a little, to neighboring points on that oil sheen, where matter had slightly different properties. Most of the new matter they created was different from, but not really better than, naturally occurring matter. After a lot of patient toil, they were able to slide around to nearby regions of the oil sheen where matter was better, more useful, than what nature has provided us. And I believe that Fra Erasmus here already has an opinion on what the geometers are made of.
So unready was I to hear my name called that I didn't even move for several seconds. Fra Paphlagon was looking at me. In an effort to jog me out of my stupor, he added,
Your friend, Fra Jesri, was kind enough to share your observations concerning the parachute.
Yes, I said, and discovered that my throat needed clearing.
It was nothing
special, not as good as new matter.
If the geometers had learned the art of making new matter, Paphlagon translated, they'd have made a better parachute.
Or come up with a way to land the probe that was not so ridiculously primitive, Barb sang out, drawing glares from the Doines. His name hadn't been called.
Fra Taverner makes an excellent point, said Fra Jad, diffusing the situation. Perhaps he shall have more of interest to say later, when called upon.
The point being, I take it, said Ignatha Forrell, that the geometers, the four groups of them, I should say, each use whatever kind of matter is natural in the cosmos where they originated.
The four have been given provisional names, announced Javarin. Antarchs, Panches, Diasps, and Quators.
This was the first and probably the last time Javarin was going to get a laugh out of the table.
They all sound vaguely geographical, said Suhr Asquin. But
it's been observed that four planets are depicted on their ship, Javarin continued. This is clearly visible on Saint Orlo's phototype. A planet is depicted on each of the four vials of blood that came in the probe. People have given them informal names inspired by their geographical peculiarities.
So, let me guess, Panji has one large continent?
Asked Suhr Asquin.
Diasp, a lot of islands, obviously,
put in Lodagir.
On Quator, most of the landmasses are at low latitude, Javarin said. And Antarctica's most unusual feature is a big ice continent at the South Pole.
Then, perhaps anticipating another correction from Barb, he added,
Or whichever pole is situated at the bottom of the picture.
Barb snorted.